Welcome to the keynote speech and Q&A with RBA Acting Assistant Governor Marion Koller. My name is Julia Specchia, and I am the Australia and New Zealand Rate Strategist at UBS. We are going to hear about the outlook for the Australian economy, and we will have about 15 minutes for Q&A after the speech. If you would like to submit a question, you can do so using the UBS app for the conference. Marion Koller was born in Germany. She took a PhD at the European University Institute in Florence and worked at the Bank of England before moving to Australia. Here in Australia, she joined the RBA in 2001. She worked for the RBA's economic department and spent a few years in the financial markets area. She covered different positions, including head of the domestic market department, and she's now acting assistant governor at the RBA. I know we are all looking forward to this discussion, so let's get started. Dr. Koller, I would like to turn it over to you.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we meet today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past and present, and any First Nations people with us today. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today. And I would like to thank UBS for the invitation to speak at this year's Australasia conference. Today, I would like to talk about two topics. The first is how we see the outlook for the Australian economy. The second topic is the balance in the labour market. There, I want to follow up on a recent speech by the Governor and say a bit about approaches we use to assess where we are relative to full employment. However, before turning to the outlook ahead, I'd like to look briefly in the rearview mirror. We've recently reviewed our economic forecasts for the year just past. This annual exercise is always revealing. But the biggest lesson is usually that humility is important when forecasting. That was particularly so a year ago, as the steep rise in inflation in 22 had caught many forecasters by surprise, and not just here in Australia. Fortunately, the difference between what happened and what we expected a year ago is less dramatic this time round. In very broad terms, the Australian economy has evolved as we expected a year ago. GDP growth has slowed, labour market conditions have eased a little, and headline inflation has fallen. Now I need to find the clicker. Here we go. As you can see, from its peak of close to 8% in late 22 to just under 5.5% now. This fall was driven by lower goods price inflation as global supply chain issues improved. However, inflation is still too high, and underlying inflation is higher than we expected a year ago. This reflects strong domestic cost pressures and a still robust level of aggregate demand. Prices of many services have been rising briskly in Australia. I also want to note that services price inflation has been slow to decline in many other economies. Finally, the echoes of the pandemic disruptions were still evident in two notable developments over the past year. First, a rapid rebound in population boosted GDP growth, but had little overall impact on the unemployment rate. And second, poor productivity outcomes added to labour costs. Both developments are also influencing our near-term outlook. Hot off the press is our statement on monetary policy, which was published on Friday. It includes our latest forecasts. So let's now look ahead and say a bit about the outlook for the Australian economy over the next couple of years. The key features of the outlook are quite similar across advanced economies. That's not surprising given the succession of global shocks in recent years, including the pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the sharp increase in energy and commodity prices. And given that governments and central banks have generally responded in similar ways. Growth in advanced economies has held up better than expected in the face of a range of headwinds. Even so, growth in most of these countries has slowed to below average rates, and a further slowing is in prospect as tighter financial conditions continue to work their way through these economies. Australia is no different, with GDP growth expected to be below trend over the year ahead. This is mainly because of subdued growth in household consumption as cost of living pressures, higher interest rates, and higher tax payable all continue to weigh on disposable incomes for a time. That said, demand has proved more resilient than we expected a few months ago. Public and business investment have been strong of late, supported by a large pipeline of construction and public infrastructure work. And a rapid rebound in the number of international students and tourists has contributed to robust growth in overall consumer spending domestically. These factors are expected to continue to support growth in the near term. They also help to explain why we have upgraded the outlook for growth over the coming year. Further ahead, growth is expected to forecast to pick up gradually towards trend, and you can see that here in the graph. This is expected to be driven by a pickup in consumption growth as the pressures on household budgets from inflation fade, and household wealth is supported by higher prices in the established housing market. The very tight labour market conditions of the past year have begun to ease. Given below trend growth, they are expected to continue doing so over the forecast period. A key margin of adjustment is expected to be a decline in average hours worked. This reflects a longer run structural shift in the way labour markets adjust during periods of growth, slow growth. Employment is expected to grow throughout the forecast period, though for a time it's expected to grow more slowly than the working age population. The unemployment rate is forecast to increase and to be around 4.25% in 2025. That's a smaller increase than in our August forecast due to the stronger than expected outlook for economic activity. Broader labour underutilisation rates are also expected to rise gradually as the labour market moves into balance. I'll return to the topic of the labour market when discussing our full employment objective. Inflation has been declining over the past year as the direct impact of earlier supply shocks have faded. That decline is expected to continue as below trend growth helps to bring demand and supply into balance. But we now expect this to be more gradual than we previously thought, due to the still high level of domestic demand and strong labour and other cost pressures. Nevertheless, inflation is expected to be a little below 3% at the end of 25. Much of the decline in inflation so far has been driven by lower goods price inflation, as you can see on the left-hand side of the graph. I think that's your left-hand side. This was helped by the improvement in global supply chains and a decline in raw materials price inflation. We expect that this has a bit further to run because the easing in global upstream costs continues to pass through to the final prices and demand growth continues to slow. A further easing in goods price inflation would also be consistent with what we have seen in other advanced economies. By contrast, domestically sourced inflation, in particular service price inflation, has been widespread and slow to decline. For example, you can see on the right-hand side of the graph that the prices of market services are rising briskly. These services cover around one-fifth of the CPI basket, and their prices are amongst the most sensitive to domestically generated inflation pressures. More broadly, still strong levels of demand have allowed businesses to pass on cost increases to customers. Business costs such as energy, rent, and insurance have risen strongly, and labour costs have been pushed up by poor productivity outcomes. Wages growth has also picked up over the past year, but now appears to have broadly stabilised. It is forecast to decline gradually over the next couple of years as labour market conditions ease. Importantly, our forecasts assume that productivity growth increases to its pre-pandemic trend. And on that basis, the outlook for nominal wage growth is broadly consistent with the inflation target. The next stage in bringing inflation back to target is likely to be more drawn out than the first. That's been the experience of some other advanced economies, which have been a little ahead of Australia in this inflation cycle. And the recent increase in fuel prices is also a timely reminder that upside surprises from supply shocks could affect headline inflation. All to say, the road ahead could be bumpy. One of the key risks is the possibility that high inflation today could lead households and businesses to expect high inflation in the future, and so put upward pressure on actual prices and wages. Encouragingly, measures of medium-term inflation expectations have generally remained consistent with the inflation target. But if high inflation did become entrenched in people's expectations, it would be very costly to unwind, involving even higher interest rates and a larger rise in unemployment. I've so far said a lot about inflation, but less about the other part of our mandate, maintaining full employment. That's an important objective. Being employed and able to work the number of hours desired not only provides people with an income, but it also gives them a sense of purpose and helps to foster mental and physical well-being. Many of the costs of unemployment and underemployment also tend to be borne by certain groups within society, such as the young, people on lower incomes, and those with less wealth. The governor recently spoke about what full employment means in the context of setting monetary policy. And she spoke how it complements the Australian government's broader full employment objective set out in the recent white paper. For full employment, for monetary policy, full employment is the level of employment at which there's balance between demand and supply in the labour market and in the markets for goods and services, with inflation at the inflation target. This is the maximum level of employment that's consistent with our price stability mandate. Monetary policy is two objectives. Maintaining low and stable inflation and full employment are closely intertwined. When demand for goods and services exceeds supply, product and labour markets will be tight and there will be upward pressure on inflation and wages growth. By contrast, when there's spare capacity in the economy, with supply exceeding demand, there will be downward pressure on inflation and wages growth. In considering the outlook for inflation, we assess the degree of balance in the markets for goods and services as well as in the labour market. What I want to focus on now is the ways in which we assess labour market conditions against our objective of maintaining full employment. In practice, full employment, or how close we are to full employment, is not something we can observe or measure directly. It cannot be comprehensively summarised by a single statistic or just one measure. And it changes over time as the structure of the economy evolves. Instead, we have to infer how close we are to full employment from what we can see is happening in the labour market and the wider economy across a broad range of measures. So how do we do this? One approach taken by economists is to use statistical models to estimate what labour market outcomes would be consistent with full employment based on what we've seen in the past. Typically, the focus has been on estimating the rate of unemployment that puts neither upward nor downward pressure on inflation or labour cost growth. This is on the basis that this unemployment rate corresponds to both balance in the labour market and in the markets for goods and services. By comparing this estimate to actual unemployment, we can get a sense of the tightness in the labour market, in effect, how close we are to full employment. A shortcoming of focusing on unemployment is that it provides only a partial picture of labour market spare capacity. in addition to people who are unemployed, there are many people who are employed, but they would like to work extra hours. This is known as underemployment. In fact, in recent decades, underemployment has grown in importance as a source of spare capacity relative to the unemployment rate. Underlying that is a long-running trend increase in people working part-time. Part-time workers are more likely to be underemployed than full-time workers. There has also been a related shift in the way the labour market adjusts to changes in labour demand. Compared with a few decades ago, now a greater share of the adjustment tends to happen through changes in hours worked rather than headcount. For that reason, we also look at a broader underutilisation rate, which captures the shortfall of hours worked due to both unemployment and underemployment, and you can see those measures in the graph I just put up. We can apply the same statistical methods that we use for unemployment to estimate a broader underutilization rate consistent with stable inflation. But model estimates, whether based on unemployment or underutilization, are useful, but they're only a starting point for assessing labour market conditions. That's because these measures are estimated imprecisely, especially in real time. Here is an illustrative range of central estimates from a selection of models. Importantly, this range does not capture the uncertainty around the estimate from each individual model, which is considerable. You can also see that the estimates change over time. Over the past 20 years, the estimated levels of unemployment and underutilization, consistent with full employment, have drifted down in response to structural changes in the economy. To get a fuller picture of labour market balance, we look at a suite of indicators in addition to statistical models. We also talk to businesses through our liaison programme. We consider research and views of academics and market economists. We talk to government agencies, international organisations, and other central banks. And we engage with key stakeholders that represent the interests of workers and disadvantaged groups in the economy. Drawing conclusion from this broad set of information requires careful judgment. Our suite of indicators is covered in detail in our quarterly statement on monetary policy, and you can also find it in previous speeches. I showed a graph from the statement on monetary policy, which are indicators that were covered in the most recent edition of the statement. It's a selection of measures of labour market tightness, including job vacancies, labour availability constraints, and labour utilisation across different groups of people that are most sensitive to the economic cycle. All of these show conditions are easing, but are still tight, and you have to take my word for it, but just open the statement and you'll find it there. We also monitor many other indicators, which all together tell a similar story of relatively tight labour market conditions. These indicators can all be summarised into a few high-level categories. They're indicators of labour demand, such as job ads and vacancies, firms' hiring intentions, and business survey measures of labour constraints. Then there are indicators of labour supply. For example, changes in labour force participation affect labour supply and so can add or reduce spare capacity. Some of these can be a response to the economic cycle, and we call those marginally attached workers. And they tend to get drawn into employment when the labour market is very tight, but they leave the labour force when there is a lot of spare capacity. The pronounced swings in immigration seen in recent years have also had implications for labour supply, especially in some industries. We can also look at a range of quantity indicators to gauge labour market tightness, such as underutilisation, the unemployment rate, I showed you both of those earlier, labour utilisation for groups of people that are more sensitive to the economic cycle, such as young people or such as the medium-term unemployed people. The number of job vacancies relative to job seekers and the share of workers that choose to switch jobs. And finally, there are price indicators of the overall balance of demand and supply. Wages outcomes combined with productivity provide insights into the balance of supply and demand in the labour market, and inflation outcomes into the balance in both labour and product markets. Here, we've brought together some of these measures in a visual dashboard summary. I should highlight that the information here is based on the actual data since 2000 and does not incorporate any of the model estimates, such as those I've discussed earlier. Each row shows the latest observation for an indicator as a blue dot. A greater degree of labour market tightness is associated with blue dots further to the right. The shaded area shows the typical range of outcomes over the past 20 or so years. This dashboard suggests that the labour market remains quite tight across a range of dimensions. Of course, we need to be careful here. An indicator that's outside its typical historical range might give us a signal about labour market tightness, or it might just reflect that the typical level of that indicator has drifted down or up over time for a given level of labour market tightness. For example, we think that labour market is in balance now at a lower rate of unemployment than it was 20 years ago. In this case, the unemployment rate, when the economy is at full employment, is likely to be below the middle of the historical range of observations from the past two decades. So, in practice, we need to look carefully at these and the other indicators to inform our overall judgment. There is no mechanical link between this dashboard and our overall view of the labour market. So, let me sum up. Our full employment objective is integral to the welfare of Australians. I've set out some of the ways in which we assess conditions in the labour market relative to full employment. In short, there's no single measure, so we use a range of indicators to form an overall judgment. We currently expect a further gradual easing in the labour market, resulting from a period of below-trend growth in aggregate demand for goods and services. We expect inflation to continue to decline, but more gradually than anticipated 3 months ago. Higher interest rates are working to help establish a more sustainable balance between supply and demand across the economy. This is expected to support the return to low and stable inflation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time and comments, Dr. Koller. Myron Koller has a hard stop in 15 minutes, so I will jump straight into questions. The first question is, you just said that you revised or reviewed the process to do forecast. Has the RBA adopted any step to improve its forecasting and modelling, given as well the miss in terms of inflation?
Yes. So we have done, obviously last year, as I said, was a humbling experience. I think, though, I'm in good company there. So we all had a big miss getting out of the pandemic. And we have done a thorough review of our forecasts. And some of the things that we've done is we've expanded the range of models. What we found, we and other central banks, is that we need to understand supply shocks better and how they work through the economy. So we're having now some additional models on the side that would allow us to look exactly at that nexus. We are also adjusting our forecasts with off-model information, such as liaison survey information. If the drivers of inflation are not captured in our models, we, like everyone else, have models that are very much geared to the demand side of the economy. So you need to bring that information back in. And we're looking at our international peers and see what they're doing. We've been, to some extent, lucky in that we're behind the inflation experience of other advanced economies, and so we have been able to watch and learn from what's been going on there. And then finally, we've expanded the range of timely data that we have. There's not only the monthly CPI now, but we have detailed rents data, detailed micro data, wages. That's really expanding something we've been done for a long time already. But that's been particularly useful to get a better timely now read of the economy.
Thank you. So when deciding on the direction for monetary policy, how much does the RBA rely on its modelling and forecast, and how much of that is liaison or judgment? And has that changed over the years? Do you rely a bit less on modelling now because they've been so inaccurate recently?
I think you need to use both, and the board has certainly used both forecasts. Models are very good in informing forecasts, and because we have an instrument that affects economic activity with a lag, we do need to take a stance on what is happening in the future. But what's particularly important is the point estimate further out is actually not the key piece of information. The key piece of information is the risks around those forecasts further out. And that is really what informs the policy setting. So we need both. We use a lot of liaison for where we're here and now. But if you need to look 2 years ahead, I think it's a little bit hard to go past the kind of more structured forecasting exercises around models. But we have become a little bit more nimble in which models we use and how we augment them in a judgment. So I would say it's probably a broader umbrella that we're looking at now.
The RBA is seeking to cool inflation while pursuing a soft landing or avoiding a recession. And there is a growing debate in Australia on whether what the RBA has done so far is enough to achieve the midpoint of the target band. Do you feel confident that the cash rate is restrictive enough?
The cash rate is currently restrictive. I think there's little doubt about that. The economy is growing below trend. We know that many households are experience a painful squeeze on their budgets, but that's also because high inflation erodes real incomes. And consumption has slowed considerably. So the big policy question that we and other central banks are having is it restrictive enough to get inflation down over a reasonable time frame such that inflation expectations remain anchored? And that's really where some of the judgment and the debate is around. But there's no question that it is restrictive. There's no question that the economy is growing below trend.
And then one question that's well from the floor. The RBA said that current nominal wage growth doesn't put at risk achieving the inflation target. So long as we get a turnaround in productivity, what do you think that could drive that pickup in productivity? And why do you think Australia productivity is weaker compared to other advanced economies? Yeah.
So this is really a very good question and a very big question. We don't forecast productivity. We have found this very hard. I also acknowledge there's other government agencies that have better levers around productivity. But what we have observed is that productivity growth outcomes have been rather poor in recent years. It's a bit hard to look at it year from year because the pandemic has moved the measured productivity around a lot, with kind of employment initially moving into higher productivity manufacturing sectors and then coming out into the services sector that are a lower level of productivity, so you get shift shares in there. But if you look through that and take a stance over a couple of years, you find that productivity hasn't grown for quite a few years now. It's actually something we do see in other economies as well. Where we don't see it is the United States, and if someone has the answer as to why they are ahead, I'd be very happy to hear that. They have always been on the technology frontier, but there is certainly something to be learned there. But we have seen in other economies, and so one possible explanations of the past couple of years is obviously that the pandemic has just made it harder for firms to focus on productivity increases. There were difficulties to get labour, difficulties to get investment capital into their businesses to install. So hopefully that is going to provide a little bit of an uplift. But it is really the big question. What we are expecting is for productivity to pick up to round about the growth rates we've seen before the pandemic. So we're not expecting a big pickup, a huge pickup. I think it's just under 1%. And that had already stepped down from previous decades. There's a longer run issue happening here. So all this to say, I don't have the precise answer. I don't forecast it, but we do need to get productivity pick up for the wage rates that we have, the normal wage rates we have forecast to be consistent with the inflation target.
And so a follow-up question. So you expect productivity back to pre-pandemic levels, and you also expect wage growth, or the RBA expect wage growth to remain contained over coming years. What's the driver of that? That wages growth remaining relatively contained compared to other economies? Is that migration, interest rates, a combination of?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So wages growth contained is between 3.5% and 4% compared to where we were pre-pandemic. That is still quite a bit higher. We were more in the twos then. So I just should also say that that's not by recent, you know, decades low wages growth, but it's also not too high wages growth. So that's just the first thing I want to say. But one of the phenomena has been, in fact, that in other countries, wages growth has taken up a little bit further. It's hard to know what it is, but there are actually very deep differences in the structural settings of wages. In Australia, we have a different wage agreement. It is more of a decentralised bargaining agreement. Some other countries, you have automated CPI clauses in the wages in there, and we've seen it in some of the European countries where we've seen actually wage rates grow at quite higher levels. And we don't have that here in Australia, and this certainly helped us. The other feature to point out is that the EBAs that we have are typically 3 years, and so that means you get a lagged effect. Now, that lagged effect is on the way up. Lagged effect is also on the way down once you have high wages, but that certainly helped those parts in the labour market where EBAs are underpinning wage growth help contain the wage rises. I think that's, hopefully answered
the question. So one other question from the floor. For the 10 years post-GFC, we had very low interest rates. We saw low inflation despite unemployment going lower than anyone expected. Growth was reasonable but lower than most expected. Central banks call this a conundrum given how stimulatory low rates should have been. How do you rationalize those 10 years compared to what we see now? And can global growth be sustained above what we saw in the last 10 years?
Yeah. This is a very good question, and I'm going to be here really honest. I don't think we quite know the answer of why we had the low growth before the pandemic. Some people said, well, interest rates don't work anymore. I think the recent episode showed us that actually they do. So I think this is still a matter of research to fully understand that earlier period where we didn't see... there was a bit of weakness consumption, and it wasn't just here in Australia, and there was wages growth that was sitting in there. I think one want to point out, and I'm not going to go there, is obviously you also need to consider the broader setting. Monetary policy is only one setting that actually affects the demand side of the economy. Fiscal policy would be another one. And so if you look at that, you can kind of explain some differences, but you certainly cannot explain the whole period, and that, you know, that makes it a little bit difficult to do the future gazing if you don't know what explained that episode. But we are in a very different environment right now, and that is what we're at the moment focused about. Inflation is too high, and we need to bring that down. So that was a very different experience to what we had before the pandemic.
So Mortgage costs have increased by almost 3% in Australia since when you started increasing rates. I have a variable mortgage, so I know that very well. And that has increased much more than in any other advanced economy because the cash flow effect here is different. How would you explain the pickup in housing prices that we are experiencing in Australia? And are you, or is the RBA concerned about what that could mean for spending?
Yeah. Fundamentally, you know, house prices, that's it's demand for established housing and the supply it meets. Some of that is in a roundabout way probably related to the population growth we've seen, but certainly not all. We've seen house prices pick up since the beginning of the year. But we've always pondered and done a lot of research what explains house price dynamics in Australia. And one theme that keeps on coming up is actually limited supply and the constraints on supply to meet that additional demand. Moreover, it takes usually a couple of years for supply to come online. So we have not only had population growth, that might explain part of why they picked up, but we actually have had strong labour markets and therefore, strong incomes across the economy. A lot of people have jobs who didn't used to have jobs. And that certainly will also underpin some demand for housing. And there might have also been the issue of expectations of future rate rises that kind of has picked it up. I think a year ago, no one quite knew how far interest rates would be going. I think we're certainly now in this in the third phase after you came out of the first phase of moving it into from removing stimulus to moving restrictive. We're there now. It's really just a question of gauging the level that is required to bring inflation down over a reasonable time. So I think the outlook for interest rates is quite a different one, or the uncertainty around the outlook for many people in, you know, who want to buy a property in the housing market. To some extent, what has also been a phenomenon over the recent period, we've seen very low turnover and supply in the market, and that might have exacerbated some of those measured house price increases, and that might pick up a little bit further. We've also seen not that much credit growth so far to underpin that. So you can kind of see if you don't have a lot of turnover, not a lot of credit growth, that might also just exacerbate some of the house price increases. So we're expecting the house price to continue to increase, but at a lower rate. But so there's the three factors that I have played a role in the recent pickup in house prices.
We're coming to an end, so thanks very much for your time, Dr. Koller, and thanks everyone for participating at this session today.
Thank you.